Okay, so let's start. And I thought tonight I'm going to talk about something maybe a little bit difficult. We'll see what happens, what comes out of it. But one of the things that I understand has been in the news quite a bit recently, it also happened quite a lot during the retreat that we had at Bodhinyana Monastery. And one of the things that, of course, concerns, I think, a large part of the Buddhist world, and that is the situation in Burma with the Rohingyas, the Muslims, and the problems that have happened over there. And I thought it might be interesting to talk about that. It's a difficult subject. Sometimes it's hard to get kind of reliable information, you know, wonder sometimes what's really going on. But I think that one of the purposes of being a Buddhist monk and one of the purposes of being part of a Buddhist community is to bring up and look at these kind of difficult issues and see, try to understand them from a Buddhist point of view. This is not going to be, it's not going to be a talk about politics, so don't worry about that. But it's going to be how to apply spiritual values in these kind of situations and what is actually going on in this particular case. And I feel as a monastic, I shouldn't really be afraid of bringing up controversial things. Many people are probably going to find some of the things I say are going to be disagreeable, they're going to disagree with me. So be it. The more important thing is to talk about these things and to see if maybe we can help to resolve some of these difficult issues in our world. And one of the reasons how this came up for me is because just a couple of weeks ago, I went to Curtin University. I gave a talk about Buddhism and human rights. Yeah, it's one of the nice things about being a Buddhist monk. You get invited to go to Curtin University to give talks about Buddhism and human rights. Like, pretty cool, isn't it? Yeah. Usually you sit back in your monastery, you do nothing. You're not involved with the world at all. And then you kind of have this almost exact opposite. You go to Curtin University and you wander around the campus. You feel like you're a completely different world from the monastery. Curtin University campus is like sense impressions in big doses coming into you. And very lots of people, you know, wandering around. What a massive difference. It was just towards the very end of the rains retreat I was doing this. But it's interesting because as a Buddhist monk, you're always in an environment where you are quite protected. You always talk with other people who are Buddhists, yeah? And when you say something, everybody says, sadhu, we agree, yeah? But when they go to Curtin University, nobody says sadhu. They say, what? Well, you can't say that. What is going on here? It's a very different environment. And that is actually interesting because it challenges you a little bit. And it makes you have to think about things in a slightly deeper and different way from what you normally do. So I enjoy these things. And I kind of find it quite fascinating. And it's a kind of opportunity for growth. And it is, in a sense, it is this meeting, if you like, of religion and secularism. A university is like a place, it's a secular place where you teach secular subjects. And then you come in as a Buddhist monk and you think, yeah, this is a religious person. So you get this meeting between the secular and the religious. And one of the things that you find out very quickly when you have this dialogue with secular society is that very often this idea that there is a massive divide on the one hand between the secular and the religious on the other hand, that there's this enormous divide between the two. Actually, very often that is not the case. Very often there's large areas of overlap between the secular and the religious. Sometimes there are things that look, people call secular that actually are quite religious. Sometimes there are things in religion that are quite secular. It's more like a spectrum, yeah? And somewhere along that spectrum, we all exist. And for that reason, when you give a talk at a place like Curtin University about Buddhism and human rights, you start to see the commonality between these things. We're not two separate worlds. We're not like A and B, and kind of you have to fight it out. Yeah, actually, we have a lot in common. And very often, if you want to live in the world in harmony, and you want to kind of function together and work together, rather than always distinguishing the differences, yeah, and always saying kind of we're like fire and water, and we end up clashing if you always look at the differences, and we always divide each other, divide us, divide society up into communities and subgroups. That is very often where conflict comes from. Yeah, I am different from you. I know more than you do, and these kind of things. But when you see the commonalities, it very often brings us together. So very interesting, therefore, to give this talk there and to look at some of those commonalities. And of course, one of the first things that arises when you talk about human rights, and of course, this is why the Rohingya thing came up, yeah? Human rights problems, perhaps, in Myanmar, all this. So one of the first things that come up is human rights and Buddhism. Are they compatible with each other? You know, or are these things completely different things that relate to completely different realms? And of course, there is no secret, really. I think it's fairly obvious that there must be a lot of commonality between Buddhist principles, Buddhist teachings, and human rights. And this is one of the things I want to point out tonight. But the other interesting thing is whether Buddhism actually has something to add to the human rights debate. What is human rights founded on? What are the basic principles that make it work? Does Buddhism, in fact, have something to add to that debate? Can we say something, you know, can we actually maybe help to even bolster this idea of human rights through Buddhist principles? This is another area which is very interesting, because that's what I found when I went there. This is not the first time, I went there last year as well. You find that some of the Buddhist ideas, people really pick up on this and think, wow, that's really interesting. It's a very different way of looking at the world from what the majority of people are used to. Because Buddhism has some teachings that are pretty unique. You only find them in Buddhism. And when you apply those, and this is what's interesting in life, yeah, to apply these profound ideas to our daily life, to the political situation, or whatever it is, this is what is interesting. When we apply these things, things come out that are very unexpected. And this is one of the things that happened when I went to Curtin University and discussed this matter. But of course, the first thing, as I was saying, it is not really obvious that there should be a meeting of minds, if you like, between Buddhism and human rights. And the reason is because human rights is really in the realm of politics, it's in the realm of justice, it's in the realm of governance and all of these things, whereas Buddhism is very often in the private realm. It's about spiritual growth, about how to develop ourselves, yeah? Internal, how to make your mind more bright, more positive, how to develop morality, how to be more compassionate. This is what Buddhism is about. It's an internal development. And it's not really obvious why that should find any crossover with things in the external world. On the other hand, I think it's also fairly obvious that the external world is very often a reflection of who we are as human beings. How we govern our society, what our institutions are like, are often a reflection of our own internal lives. So also, at the same time, it's not so improbable. But what you have to do, you have to draw things out of the Buddhist teachings, because the Buddha doesn't talk about governance, he doesn't say much about these things. So you have to start from another set of principles. This is the first thing which looks like a barrier, but I don't think it really is one. But the other thing which I find very fascinating, once you start to look at the details of the Buddhist teachings and the Buddhist language, the Buddhist language is the Pali language. Ancient Indian language comes from about 2,500 years ago, very closely related to Sanskrit. And it so happens I've been a monk now for 22 years, is that right? 23 years? Something like that, 22 years. And, you know, part of the education of a monk very often is to learn these ancient languages. And it's fascinating when you study these things. It's actually very interesting. A lot of really kind of interesting insights come out of this. And one of these insights that comes out of this is the cultural crossover between cultures around the world. So how do we actually see that? And one way of seeing that, when you give a talk about human rights, yeah, you think, right, what does rights mean? Yeah, so you look into this, I read up a little bit about human rights, and of course, the word right, the original meaning of that is like straight, to be upright, yeah, that's right. You sit down, when you watch your breath, this is like straight from the suttas, it says in the suttas, you sit down, close your eyes, put your body straight in a straight position, and then you start watching the breath. So this is like the literal meaning of the word right. Yeah, straight, literal meaning, straight. But then there is a metaphorical meaning. And the metaphorical meaning is that it is also used to describe morality here. You say somebody has an upright character, yeah? It means that they are moral, they have integrity, they practice kindness, they are upright in their character. Yeah? And that is a metaphorical meaning that is a kind of derived from the literal meaning of just being straight. Yeah? So this is the way, and then from there comes then the idea of human rights, yeah? A right that we have. We can expect society to act towards us in a certain way. That's what human rights is all about. We expect governments and institutions to treat us fairly. That's what human rights really is about. So this is the side, this is the English language, yeah? And then the fascinating thing here, you look at Pali language. In Pali you have a word called Uju. And this word Uju is the Sanskrit equivalent of that is Ruju. Now Ruju comes from the same source as the English word right. Yeah, the root word is exactly the same word. That word traveled from somewhere in the Middle East, Iran perhaps, that area. It traveled west into Europe and it became words like right and straight and rectitude and all these kind of things. Rectitude like from Latin root. And then they traveled east to India and there it became the word Uju, but it's the same root. And then if you look at how that word Uju is used in the suttas, it is used, first of all, to mean straight in the literal sense, and it's also used metaphorically to mean upright character. Yeah, isn't that fascinating? These are languages that separated from each other maybe 4,000, 5,000 years ago. One group going east, one group going west, and the commonalities still existing in a simple word like Uju and right are so strong after 2,500 years, after 4,000 to 5,000 years. It's quite astonishing here. It shows us, to me, that our world is so united. We have so many things in common. We're not as divided as we like to think. We always like to think, yeah, you know, I'm Australian, or I was born in Norway. I'm not really sure what I am anymore, but maybe kind of half Australian, half Norwegian, or half Buddhist, or that's one and a half. That's a bit too much. Anyway, you know what I mean, right? Many things coming together, become a conglomeration of things. And we divide the world up in this way. But when you start to look at these cultural interactions, language, culture, how we use words, even how we use metaphors, exactly the same metaphor in ancient India as you find in English language, and probably also all other European languages. Wow, the world kind of becomes so small. We say the world is small today, but it has been small for a very, very long time. This is really the point here. And of course, those Buddhist ideas that then went from that were Indian, that were part of the Buddhist culture, they weren't confined just to India, but they spread out also to large parts of Asia, to East Asia, to China, Japan, Korea, and all Eastern Asia as well. So they too, I don't actually know this, but you can assume because they are Buddhist cultures, they too will have those concepts in there that Uju, straight, has both a metaphorical and a literal meaning. Yeah, so this is very fascinating, and this kind of brings our world together. We have far more in common than sometimes we like to think. Yeah? We like to think that we are special. Actually, we're not really special, you know. It's terrible, isn't it? We're not special. Everybody wants to be special. We're all pretty much the same. Oh, that's a bit of a downer. I apologize for saying that. That's kind of but it's kind of nice, yeah? We don't have to be special. We shouldn't be special. And it's kind of, it's a good thing. It's a burden taken off your shoulders that you don't have to be anyone special. You're just a human being, and we're all human beings together. And what a wonderful thing that actually is. So that is just to show us that sometimes people say, this is a Western idea, this is an Asian idea. It's not really like that. The world is not, in my opinion, quite divided up like that. We have very much the same propensities, the same things inside of us, and which gives rise to a very high degree of commonality between people in this world. But anyway, so that is just to... I find these things very fascinating. I hope you find it fascinating too. Otherwise, if you find what I'm saying incredibly boring, please, you know, you're always allowed to leave. I empathize with you if you find it boring. That's okay. But so what then about Buddhism and human rights? I want to get back to this a little bit before I talk about more kind of politically difficult things. And one of the things that is difficult in human rights is, yes, it is like a moral system in many ways, but where does morality arise from in secular society? Where does secular society get its moral values from? It's not obvious, yeah? I mean, if you have a theistic religion, God created the universe, and of course, if God says that certain laws are morality, if he created, he or she or it created the universe, okay, fair enough, you're going to have to say, okay, you're also allowed to lay down the laws of morality, yeah? If you are the creator of the universe, kind of makes sense. And of course, this makes it very easy. If you have a religion where you have a creator God or goddess or godit or whatever it is, yeah, so that is very, makes things very simple there. But what about secular society? It's not so obvious. We have to look at the roots of morality, where morality comes from, somewhere else. And this is one of the difficult things in the debate of human rights. Where does morality come from? And who comes to the rescue? Buddhism. Yeah, we come to the rescue. We say we actually have in Buddhism a very natural system of morality. And I think the Buddhist system of morality, I think it can be imported directly into human rights and used as a foundation for the whole human rights idea. So what is the Buddhist idea of morality here? It is very simple. Yeah. And so the idea of Buddhist morality is that it is a morality based on intention. It's an intention-based morality. Yeah. And if you intend for the well-being of people around you or animals or whatever around you, then you're doing something positive, something moral. Yeah. And if you intend for somebody else's detriment, for their harm, or whatever it is, then it is immoral. Yeah. It is based on intention, very, very simple, and also very obvious, because we all know everybody wants to be happy. Nobody wants more suffering. Yeah, that's why maybe you're all here today, because you think that this is going to be for happiness. Maybe you're hoping I wouldn't talk about Rohingyas and human rights, but you know what I mean? This is why we're here. That's why I am a Buddhist, for sure. I'm a Buddhist because I believe it has something to... very powerful message about happiness and suffering in this world and how to live in a good and the right way. So because we feel, because we experience the world, this is one of the basic things about ideas, which I think is so obvious. We experience the world, and we experience the world either in a positive or negative or neutral way. Because we experience the world in that way, other people have the ability to either cause pain for you or happiness for you. Cause pain for others, it's immoral. Cause happiness for others, it's moral. Very simple intention-based ethics. But it's weird if you look at the philosophy around human rights. It is not easy, yeah, for them to come up with these sort of ideas. It's not actually as obvious. So this is the first thing whereby there is a lot of meeting ground between Buddhism and human rights. The avoidance, basically, of harming other people around us. And, of course, it goes further within human rights. It's not just a personal thing. It's about institutions and governments and all of that. But it's very simple to transfer that idea of intention also onto governments and institutions, because they too have purposes and aims, right? A government has an aim one way or the other, and either they cause us harm or they can be positive for us. So again, it's not a big leap to go from the personal ethics to government ethics. So it fits in very beautifully and very nicely here. I think the Buddhist ethical ideas are so profound. It's one of the most beautiful parts of the Buddhist teachings, the Buddhist ethics, because it is an ethics that is very open. Yeah, it is incredibly open. It's not restricted by rules. You should do this, you should do that, you should not do this. It's not a rule-based ethics. It's the ethics that comes directly from our personal experience. What is our intention? What is the motivation that drives us? Are we coming from anger, from greed, and these kind of things? And it allows us to look at the world, to look at ethics in a very, very different way from the vast majority of ethical systems that are rule-based. It allows an incredible amount of flexibility, and that's why it fits so well with ideas like, you know, modern ideas of human rights and all of this. I'm not going to go into details because we have discussed many of these details before, but Buddhism can deal with things like, you know, euthanasia, assisted suicide, with abortion, with stem cell research, all of these fields can deal with that in a very sensible and compassionate manner because of its broad outlook on these things. So that is one side of a Buddhist ethics and how it fits with human rights. But another very interesting thing about Buddhist ethics is that it's not just about negative ethics. It's not just about the things that we should not do. If you read the word of the Buddha always talks about the things we actually should be doing. Yeah, how we should be living moral lives, how we should be kind and compassionate and understanding and all of these things. So it's also a positive ethics. Yeah, and if you look again at human rights has this idea that our society should also be helpful. Yeah, we should educate our young people. We should have a society that cares for people in their old age and when they're sick and all these kind of things. So the Buddhist idea of a positive ethics is also very much mirrored in human rights. So we have this idea of positive ethical things in Buddhism, which also is actually quite rare in the world, but matches with the ideas here again we find in secular society here. Yeah, and it's very important to remember that. Remember this idea of the positive ethics of Buddhism, because what it means is that it's not just about all these negative things, don't do this, don't do that, but it's this positive, beautiful idea about going out in the world, sharing what we have, being kind and compassionate to others, yeah. And this is kind of a very uplifting idea of ethics, instead of just the negative side, the positive side. And remember that, because this is a very powerful source for joy and happiness in our lives, if we can develop the positive side of ethics. The more kind you are, the more compassionate you are in life, the more you focus on the positive side of ethics, the more you are lifting yourself up. It's like filling the helium in the balloon, yeah? As the balloon expands, you fill the helium, the balloon starts to soar. That's what it feels like. It feels like you're soaring up because you're doing acts of kindness and compassion. And as you do that, you soar up just like a balloon of helium. And you feel light, you feel at ease. And after a while, you even get that bird's eye view of existence that we're trying to get in Buddhism. This is like insight and meditation experiences. Very important part of Buddhism. And again, interestingly, mirrored in the idea of human rights. Of course, Buddhist ethics goes even further. Buddhist ethics is also about the ethics of the mind, right? Buddhist ethics is incredibly profound when you start to think about it. So extraordinarily all-encompassing. So also has to do with the ethics of the mind as well. How we think, how we look at the world, how we perceive others, and all of these kind of things is also part of Buddhist ethics. It goes beyond, way beyond what human rights actually is all about. So that is just one of the ways of looking at the crossover between Buddhism and human rights, very closely related to each other. Buddhism goes much further, but there is a lot of crossover between the two. And I think Buddhist ethics can actually be used as a foundation, really, to derive the whole idea of human rights. But there is another aspect which is also very interesting in this, and that is one of the problems with human rights is it is based on the idea that we are all equal. Yeah, if any of you have read the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it begins in the beginning. We're all created equal in dignity and rights, or something like that. We're all equal in dignity and rights. That's how it begins. It doesn't tell us why that is the case. So, are we equal? Yeah, this is one of the philosophical problems with the whole human rights debate. Are we really equal? And if you look out into the world and you look what people are like, it's a very good question. How equal are we? Yeah, some people born in great poverty, some people born in great wealth, some people born in countries where people get looked after and all of this, some people born intelligent, some people far less intelligent, some people born with, we are so different. Some people are handicapped, some people are born into this world with mental illnesses and problems. On the surface of it, we say we're not equal, we're pretty different. Yeah, we are, there's nothing much to, you know, how can we say that we're equal? Does that make any sense? And this is a problem in human rights. So what does Buddhism have to say about this? And this is kind of fascinating, because one of the things of the Buddhist teachings, there are so many deep aspects of the Buddhist teachings, and this is what I want to show you, how one of the deepest aspects of the Buddhist teachings can actually be applied to a very real-life problem, such as human rights. And this is the Buddhist idea of non-self. Yeah, you've all heard about the idea of non-self. It's a core Buddhist idea. The idea of non-self is that there is no abiding essence inside of us that is always the same. We're always changing. Yeah, and I'm sure you can agree with that. Yeah, if you look inside of yourself, do you see any essence that is always the same? Or do you see changes? You probably see changes, right? Things are always moving, coming and going, feelings coming and going, perceptions coming and going. Now you want this, now you want that. Nothing really seems very stable. So I think it kind of fits, to some extent at least, with our natural understanding of ourselves. So this is the Buddhist idea of non-self. So what does this mean, this idea of non-self, in practical terms? And one of the interesting consequences of this, when you read the word of the Buddha and you see people who have just reached full awakening, they often go to the Buddha and they say to the Buddha, they give some kind of expression of that awakening. Now, one of those expressions of awakening, so if you hear anyone in here saying this, maybe they are awakened. Yeah, so now this is kind of the clue to know whether somebody is awakened or not. Yeah, so this is really exciting stuff. So what do they say? And one of the things they say is that they say something to the effect that I am not inferior, I am not equal, I am not superior. There is no inferiority, equality, or superiority among beings. Yeah, this is one of those beautiful Buddhist sayings. It's called the idea of the three kinds of conceit. And this is one of the things that you break through when you reach full awakening. No longer do you feel inferior to anybody. No longer do you feel superior to anybody. And then there's this kind of the last thing, which is really kind of surprising. Nor do you feel equal. Yeah, neither superior, nor inferior, nor equal. The three kinds of conceit, they call it in Buddhism. Equality conceit, they call it. Sounds like an oxymoron, right? Equality conceit. But this is the Buddhist idea of how the nature of the mind and what we are like. So what does this mean? And what it means, and this is kind of what is so interesting about this, how can you have equality conceit? This is because the Buddhist idea of conceit is very different from our ordinary idea of conceit. The Buddhist idea of conceit is the feeling that we have inside of us, that we exist as entities, as essences that have continuity to them. Yeah, this is what we mean by conceit in Buddhism. But if you take away that sense of essence inside of you, if you take away the sense that you have a core that is the real you, that is always there, the real me, in the final analysis, who am I? I'm this, yeah? This particular feeling, this particular person. If you take that away, and this is what the most profound Buddhist insight is all about, to see through that, what is left? And what is left is a process. And that process is ever-changing, yeah? Like I was saying before, one day you wake up in the morning, you feel negative. Another day you wake up in the morning, you feel really happy, you want to go hug everyone in the world. Another day you don't want to hug anyone, you want to go away, don't want to see you. This is how our minds are. One day you want to eat A, one day you want to eat B. One day you kind of, we are always changing, moving around. Those changes happen very continuously on the moment-to-moment basis, but they also happen over long periods of time, how we change over lifetimes, over one lifetime, I should say. I just think about myself sometimes, how I started off as a Buddhist monk, yeah? Many of you didn't know me, what I was like 22 years ago when I started out, and I'm really happy about that, because, wow, that would be really embarrassing, you know? Because you change so much when you practice a wholesome path. You become a better person over time. Yeah, and when I think what it was like 22 years ago, I think, jeepers, you know, I'm glad I got out of that, and I want to continue on this path, yeah, moving in the right direction. And so this is how we change all the time. And we're trying to, one aspect of Buddhism is to try to control that change to some extent. So we change in a positive direction and we end up as better human beings than we were before. So this is what we are. We are a changeable process, always moving from one thing to another one. Sometimes people have gender changes these days, yeah? So you go from being a man to being a woman, sometimes from being a woman to a man. And as you look at that, sometimes you start off very rich and then you blow all your money, you end up really poor. Sometimes the other way around. So who are you? If we are always changing, who is the you? How can you compare yourself to others? It is natural that when you are wealthy or you are in a powerful position, we tend to feel superior to others because of that. You look at people in the world who are powerful and wealthy, there's often the sense of entitlement there or being superior and better. But if you know that tomorrow you could have lost that power, tomorrow the wealth could be all gone, then which one of those are you? Are you the poor person without power, or are you the powerful one with lots of money? Which one are you? You are neither, you are both. Yeah, we're always changing, and because we're always changing, comparison is impossible. We are neither better, nor are we worse, nor are we equal, because equal also assumes that there is a comparison there somewhere. But when you are two changing processes meeting, how can you compare anything at all? No comparison is actually possible in this case. And we can see that in life here, yeah? As I was saying, people move from one status to another one, from a maybe from high social position to a low one, from being wealthy to being poor, from being intelligent to being stupid. Yeah, have anyone of you experienced that, going from intelligence to stupidity? There's an easy way to do that, you know? There's a way to do that, it's just according to statistics, if you go down and you just lie down, hang out on the beach for a week, you veg out on the beach for a week, doing nothing at all, at the end of that two-week period, your intelligence have dropped by 20 points or something like that, yeah? And you can check it out and see the impermanence of intelligence. And also, during life, often we are perhaps at our brightest, maybe in our early 20s or something like that, and then it's downhill from there on, yeah? It's pretty bad, actually. It's a long time since I was 20. That's pretty worrying. So all of these things are changing. And this is the point I made when I went to Curtin University. We are not entities. There is no comparison. You cannot compare people. And when you cannot compare, how are you going to, how can we not be considered equal? How can we discriminate? There is no comparison. We are equal in a much deeper sense, in that we all are processes moving around. We all have the potential for all states of humanity inside of us. It's all inside of us, waiting to come out. Yeah. And of course, that's all I could really say at Curtin University. I tried to say something about rebirth, but it doesn't really work in a secular environment. They say rebirth, oh yeah, not sure about that. But in Buddhism, it's kind of it's one of the core aspects of the Buddhist teachings. And when you take into account rebirth, of course, this idea that we are changeable processes is even much more powerful. You move from one life to being of a certain nationality, yeah, of a certain background. Next life, you are a completely different nationality. Maybe you have changed your gender as well. And maybe in a life after that, maybe you become an alien. Yeah, that would be quite cool, yeah? So maybe we should have alien rights as well, because they too are part of this whole thing. Yeah? But my point is, we're always moving around, high social position to low social position, high economic position to a low one, low intelligence to high intelligence, education to no education, handicapped to non-handicapped, yeah, and everything else, this ethnic group, that ethnic group, this language, that language, we are everything. And when we have been everything, and when we are going to everything, very likely in the future, it's all inside of us, it's already part of us. Yeah, when you look out into the world, you look at all the 7 billion peoples on this planet, the seed to be any one of those beings is already inside of you. One day, if you keep on in samsara, moving on and on, one day that seed is going to grow and prosper and come out, and you will be exactly like those people out there in the world, like any one of those 7 billion people on this planet. Now, if it is already inside of you, if you discriminate against somebody else, if you deny them their human rights or whatever, who are you really discriminating against? And the reality is that you are discriminating against yourself. You are discriminating against a potential manifestation of yourself in the future. One day you are very likely to be there. How can we discriminate against ourselves? How can we discriminate against anyone on any basis whatsoever? If you are human, you deserve the same rights as everyone else. And from this, you get a very clear and beautiful way of thinking about the idea of human rights. Non-discrimination. Everybody should be treated the same, regardless of their station in life, their background, whatever it is. Discrimination is a completely illogical from a Buddhist point of view. Not only illogical, it's just, it's allowing pain in the world when no pain really has any place whatsoever. Of course, we are inherently discriminatory as human beings, yeah? We always discriminate, and the reason why we discriminate is because of our sense of identity. I am this. This is my personality. This is who I am. But actually, it turns out to be a false construct. So watch that in yourself. Watch that inherent tendency to discriminate. It's very hard to be completely impartial, but surely, from a Buddhist point of view, that is exactly what we should be, yeah? So this is one of the very powerful, beautiful teachings of the Buddha that actually has a lot of real-life applications. And it means that the way you look at people around you changes, and you have become much more open to differences and to people in all stations of life in this world. So this is a beautiful contribution, I think, Buddhism can make to human rights. There's one very last aspect I will talk about just very, very briefly. And one of the aspects of human rights that is sometimes criticized in human rights is that democracy is also talked about there, yeah? That everybody should have a vote and everybody should be able to participate in the government. Of course, the question is, what about Buddhism? Does Buddhism have anything to say about democracy? Yeah. And you might think, Buddhism is about sitting down and watching your breath. What's that to do with democracy? It must be, there's no connection whatsoever. But of course, one of the things that the Buddha did, which is interesting, is that he did, in many ways, have also a lot to say about how to organize society. And the reason was because he established a monastic order. And when you establish an order, an institution in society, institutions always have rules and regulations. So we can look at the ideal, the Buddhist ideal, it would then be found in how that sangha, the monastic order, functions. Yeah, what are the rules, the regulations for the sangha? And one of the very interesting regulations for the sangha is precisely absolute democracy. Everybody has to agree on something when something is done. Nobody's voice doesn't count. So if somebody comes and says, "Oh, I'd like to ordain." Yeah, I don't know if anyone here wants to ordain. I would really recommend it. It's really good to be a monk, yeah, or a nun. Yeah, I agree. Some people agree, some don't. That's fine. But if you want to ordain, you have to come up here. I can't just ordain you like that, yeah. So you can feel, you can kind of take a sigh of relief from that. I can't ordain you just like that. You come to the order, come to the sangha, and you say, please, I'd like to be ordained. And then the sangha, all the monks have to come around, and if one monk says no, yeah, one monk happens not to like you, so you really have to be kind to all the monks, yeah. So this sounds like corruption, doesn't it? The monks try to be compassionate. We try not to be partial in that way. Yeah. But if all the monks agree, then you can ordain. If one monk says no, you actually can't be ordained. That's how it works. So it's an absolute majority that is required in the Buddhist idea of democracy. So we're even more democratic in Buddhism than kind of ordinary society where all you need is 50%. Here you need 100% to go through with any kind of decision. So I would say the Buddha in many ways also was very pro the democratic ideal. Democratic ideal already existed in Indian society at that time. Very much at the same time as democracy was starting out in Greece, it also existed in India. So this also is a pan-international idea. It doesn't just exist in one area of the world, it exists everywhere. And again, the world often is so much smaller than we think it is. But I promised to talk a little bit about the situation in Burma. I think I'm kind of ruining a little bit that I was going to talk about that, so I'm kind of holding off as long as possible because it's a bit kind of, we'll see what comes of this. So The Rohingya situation in Burma, I'm sure you have all read about this. It's a problem with all the refugees that are happening now, all the Rohingyas fleeing into Bangladesh from Burma, and often they end up on the seas, yeah, in rickety boats, traveling all over the place, and obviously having a really, really hard time, these Rohingyas. And there's been a clash between the Rohingyas and basically the Myanmar government, the military and all of that. So what is going on here? What is actually the problem? What is really, is it a Buddhist problem? And from my point of view, it is kind of a Buddhist problem in the sense that if you are a Buddhist, you identify as practicing the Buddhist teachings, it kind of affects you. Yeah, if the whole world starts to think that Buddhists are bad people because of what's happening in Myanmar, and you can see Buddhism has been getting a lot of bad press because of that. You see certain monks kind of, you know, saying things that are not very nice about the Rohingyas. Of course, that gives a very bad impression to the world. And because it gives a bad impression to the world, it affects us. I feel terrible when Buddhism is kind of being dragged down, because Buddhism, to me, is such a marvelous teaching. So many wonderful things in there, which has the opportunity to lift people up and make life better in this world. And instead, it's being dragged down instead by these forces that are happening. So I feel really bad about this. So it affects all of us. When something happens in a faraway corner of the world, we are all part of that in a sense. So for that reason, I think it is important that for us too to discuss these things and ask us if there are any lessons for us to be learned. And the first lesson for me when I look at this is to see what's happening there. And one of the things that is happening there is that nationalism, yeah, it's a lot to do with nationalism. This is our nation, and we are Buddhist. And Buddhist becomes a label of identity. And once you have a label of identity, I am Buddhist, we all have labels of identity, yeah? We all are somebody. We identify with one way or another. We cannot avoid that. We have to have that sense of identity. Not something you can avoid. But that identity then merges out, goes out in society, and all of these things that we take on board as part of our identity. And part of that is, in Burma, if you are a Buddhist, then I am a Buddhist is part of your identity. And this is a big problem, because if you then perceive another group of people, if you perceive them as threatening that Buddhism, yeah, and this is kind of what's happening in Burma, I think, it is perceived that the Rohingyas are threatening Buddhism, you are threatening the person, because this is your identity. So when Buddhism is threatened, you feel personally threatened by that, because it's part of who you are. And this, I think, is a very important part of the problem over there. The sense of identity politics, the sense of being threatened. Buddhism is declining. I am a Buddhist. The world is going to go under. Help! We must do something. Do whatever. And then you end up doing unfortunate things because you are identifying with this in this way as being a Buddhist. And then sometimes you get violence happening. You get people inciting others to violence. Yeah, sometimes you get monks. It looks like, anyway, to me, that sometimes you get even monks inciting people to violence, or at least bordering on that. Yeah. And what a sad thing that is when that happens. So one of the lessons, I think, for all of us here is that if we are going to have an identity, we have to be careful with how we identify with things. Sure, I certainly identify as a Buddhist, but my primary thing is not my identity as a Buddhist. My primary thing is my identity as someone who practices Buddhist principles. That is my primary identity. Yeah, and this is what I think we should all try to do as Buddhists. Our primary thing should be to be somebody who practices good principles in this world. Whether we are a Buddhist in name or not doesn't matter all that much. What really matters is how we live, living in the right way. That is what is important. And of course, if this is what happened in Burma, if the Myanmar government and everyone, all the Buddhists in Myanmar, if their identity was entangled with the idea of how they live and how they practiced, it would be a very, very different situation. Because then it would be how they deal with the Rohingyas as human beings. That would be the main issue. Yeah, and of course many Burmese people are like that. They are treating people in a very kind and a good way. And I've seen reports of that as well. And then you can reduce those clashes and problems, because instead of identifying with something in the wrong way, you're identifying with a practice that leads to peace, that leads to calm, that leads to understanding, leads to inclusion, and then the problem actually decreases from that. So please, that is what I would recommend all of you to do. Make sure we all have to have identities. Choose an identity for yourself that gives you the maximum chance of being a blessing for the world and people around you. The main identity should be, I practice Buddhist principles. Secondary, I am a Buddhist. Whether you are a Buddhist or not doesn't matter so much, as long as you practice those principles in your life. And then I think a lot of these problems would vanish just like that, because they can't really exist anymore in that kind of environment. So this to me is a powerful lesson to be learned from this kind of conflict. And the other lesson, which I also see here very quickly, very big part of this problem, is the fear that Buddhism is being undermined. Yeah, and because we are attached to Buddhism, we must support it. It's disappearing in the world. Wow, these wonderful teachings are all going. What are we going to do? Help. And then, of course, you choose the help in the wrong place because you get desperate. And then again, we need to remember what the Buddha says about Buddhism itself, what the Buddha says about all phenomena in the world. Yeah, this is Buddhism 101. Buddhism 101 says impermanent, yeah, changeable, unreliable. We don't know where it's going to go next. And so if Buddhism is threatened, or if it's not threatened, sometimes we just don't know, we assume it's threatened, but actually it's very hard to know sometimes because there are so many currents and cross currents happening here. But even if it is threatened, sometimes we just have to shrug our shoulders. There's no point in using violence to try to support Buddhism. If it really is threatened, sometimes we have to shrug our shoulders and accept this is the nature of reality. One day it is going to disappear. We don't know when it's going to be. Yeah, and because of that, we are perhaps a bit sad about it. It's unfortunate, but still we accept the reality of the world. And when we do that, something very powerful happens. Because when you accept that reality, instead of then trying to bolster Buddhism, perhaps in unwholesome ways, what we do instead is that we understand that there is a sense of urgency here. Things really are impermanent. We don't know where things are going to go next. So it actually helps us to enhance our practice and be better Buddhists rather than making us worse Buddhists. Yeah, so this looking at things in the right way actually helps us to do better in the world rather than to do worse. And I think if we are really going to be successful in supporting Buddhism, in making Buddhism last for a long time into the future, it is the last thing we should do is to go against Buddhist principles. Do things that are violent, that are unethical. That's the last thing we should do. If we do that, we're going to drag it down and make it worse. People around the world are going to say, look at this Buddhist. I thought Buddhism was a religion of peace. Obviously, it's not. So Buddhism must be bad. And we are giving Buddhism a bad name if we do that. But if we can uphold our Buddhist principles, if we can continue to act with kindness, even at difficult times, yeah, if we can do that, then I think we are creating this beautiful image of Buddhism in the world. And when we create that beautiful image, people will say, wow, these teachings are so inspiring. More people will practice this path. More people will reach the stages of awakening. More people will be in the world to uphold these teachings for the future. Then we are creating the foundation for Buddhism to last for a long time. That is, to me, the right way of going about this. So these are just some of the reflections that I have around this conflict that is happening in Burma. I don't want to tell the Burmese people what to do. It's none of my business. But I think as a Buddhist, I'm certainly concerned about what is happening over there. So what else can we say about this? And what else? I don't think there is all that much more to say, but of course, one of the obvious things that we have to do in Burma. We have to try to find some solutions to this conflict, and of course, to find a solution, we have to, first thing that we have to do, this is just standard stuff, standard conflict resolution. First of all, we have to kind of allow the superficial problems to disappear, yeah, have restraint from the side of the military, have restraint on everybody. People who do bad things have to be dealt with according to the law. Even if you are a monk, yeah, and you do bad things, you have to be dealt with according to the law. Otherwise, it's going to look partial and unfair to everyone in the country. But at the end of the day, if you're going to resolve a conflict, and this is kind of standard conflict resolution, you have to sit down and you have to listen to all sides of the conflict. Yeah, right now the Rohingyas are the ones who are bearing the brunt of the suffering in Burma. But there's a long history behind this, very, very complicated history here. I had to read a little bit about this just to feel that I had some, was a bit informed about what is going on. It's a long history, very complicated, very difficult. Everybody, the reason why there is a problem is because everyone on both sides feel they have grievances and problems. And as a Buddhist, if I'm going to have any moral authority, yes, I have to listen to the Rohingyas, also have to listen to the other side, to the Buddhists as well. Why do they have a problem? What do they feel is the problem here? And we listen to both sides in that way. Then you can maybe find some common ground and some solution to what is going on. And then perhaps we can move forward with these conflicts again. So this, to me, is just some ideas about what that conflict is all about. All conflicts are really about the same thing. And when we do that, when we live in the right way, when we practice in the right way, when we live, when we identify as practicing Buddhists rather than as have a Buddhist identity, then there is a chance that we will live this life for our own good. We will live a life for the resolution of conflicts in the world, and we will live a life that is beautiful for all of society as a consequence. And then life becomes very meaningful, at least for each one of us individually here. Okay, so that is my little talk for tonight. So there you are. Okay, so do you have anyone has any questions before we take questions from overseas? Anyone here has any questions? Remember what the Buddha said, right? He said that if you want to be wise in the future, you've got to ask questions in this life. So if you're quiet, it means that maybe you're going downhill in terms of wisdom. Yeah, that's bad news.
In that first section, yes, where you gave the illustration about, you know, the three conceits.
Yeah.
Yes?
Yes.
And then in the next section, you went on and you explained something else, and I can't put it back into your words.
Yeah.
But it was like saying you're an individual there. And I thought, so are we talking about other people or only the Buddhists have?
Okay, well, the thing is that,
the conflict is all.
Yeah, well, Buddhism, you know, what we claim as Buddhists, we claim to have, you know, the Buddhist claim is that this is how the world operates. Yeah, so from a Buddhist point of view, we all like that. Yeah, whether you have what kind of religion you come from is irrelevant, whether you have no religion or whatever. If you have enough introspection and you look inside of yourself, you do not find the sense of essence or permanence inside of you. So we all like that. And it kind of fits very nicely with modern psychology as well. You ask a modern psychologist, that's exactly what they will tell you. Things are not really stable. Things are always moving and changing around. So it's true for everyone. And because of that, I think it's something we can all appreciate, yeah? Yeah? Great, I'm glad you did, because that was kind of one of the main things I want to bring out. That's great, yeah.
Thank you for your very interesting talk tonight and your wonderful meditation. You talk about that there's no essence in us. Ajahn Brahm often talks about to believe in the goodness in all of us. And I've also sort of read about the Buddha nature, that we all have a Buddha nature, whether we are Buddhist or not, but like the good in us. So can you comment on that, please?
Yeah, okay. I suspect that when Ajahn Brahm says that, he means that we all have a potential for good. Yeah, it is there, it is inside of us. And it's just about bringing that out. Everyone has that potential. And I think that is what it really means. And the idea of Buddha nature, well, again, it depends on how we understand this idea of Buddha nature. But the way I would understand that is that we all have the potential for awakening. We all have the potential for deep understanding and these things. That is my understanding of Buddha nature. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Ron at the back there. Yeah.
I reflect about whether I am firstly a citizen of Australia or a citizen of the world.
Yeah.
And my sense is that to be a citizen of the world and recognise that element of equality, but I understand also what you're saying about equality becoming an end in itself. But yeah, could you comment about on that perspective between, you know, being Australian, being a citizen of the world, and democracy?
Yeah, I think that's very good. I think the idea of being a citizen of the world is great. I think it's a very useful perception, you know, and really, really useful, because it breaks down barriers again, breaks down barriers between people. And I mean, for some of us, it is very real. I mean, if I look at my own life, I don't really know what I am anymore, because I've kind of been living here and there and everywhere. But it's also true in a much more deeper sense than that. That's just a superficial way of looking at it. But it's true in a much deeper sense. If you are able to think of yourself as a citizen of the world, then in the future, wherever you get reborn, you will feel at home, yeah, because you will be part of that society. One of the strange things when you travel around a lot is that wherever you go, you feel that there is a basic kind of humanity which is almost exactly the same wherever you go. You can feel at home anywhere you start to realize it. If I got reborn in Africa in my next life, or in Japan, or in Sweden. Sweden is the worst, because I'm Norwegian, right? So Sweden is next door. That's the worst enemy. So even Sweden I should be able to deal with, yeah? And so the idea is that you start to break down those barriers, and you don't feel, if I was reborn anywhere, I would be happy with that. I'm not sure about Mars. That might be a bit too difficult. But you know what I mean? It's kind of really broad and really broad out. So I think that's a very positive perception. And it really helps us to break down barriers when we have this idea of being a citizen of the world. But in a much broader sense than how people normally think about it. People think, I'm a citizen of the world. I travel here. I travel there. You know, I know everything. That's a very shallow way of being a citizen of the world. Yeah. Okay, anyone else wants to ask anything? Yeah, yeah. Everybody completely, yeah? Oh, more questions over there. Okay, good. Yeah, please.
This is my first time here this evening.
Yeah.
And I just want to know if I can have a hug afterwards.
You can have a hug from anyone here who is willing to,
from
but not from me, unfortunately. I apologize, but this
you
is...
don't hug?
Not usually, no.
Okay.
Yeah. The reason is because we live celibate lives, yeah? So we don't usually have physical contact with the opposite gender.
See, I didn't know this is my first time here.
You're more than welcome to ask these kind of questions. It's not a sexist thing, because the nuns are exactly the same. The nuns don't give hugs to men, yeah?
Yes.
We don't give hugs to women. So it doesn't mean I don't like you.
I
like you. I promise you, I like you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So let's have a look at what they say from overseas. So we have from Sudamashu in the USA. How do we purify ourselves from greed, hatred, and delusion? Is there anything other than breath meditation and practicing loving kindness? Yes, there is. It's called the Noble Eightfold Path. Practice the Noble Eightfold Path in all its facets, yeah? Starting with right view, ending up with Samma Samadhi. Every factor matters. And as you do that, you're ending up at the end of that path, you have no more greed, hatred, and delusion. It sounds kind of boring. I must admit, sometimes when you hear, now, you know, you end the goal of the Buddhist path is to have no more greed, hatred, and delusion. It sounds kind of, so what? Yeah, okay. It doesn't sound very positive. But so the point here, and this is, I think, a very important point to make, if you have none of these negative aspects, you have heaps of the positive aspects. Take these things away, you have lots of compassion, you have lots of metta, you have endless patience and kindness towards the people around you, you understand people to the core. So it's not just that the defilements have disappeared and the negative qualities have disappeared. You're, at the same time, you have all these positive qualities. Otherwise, I think people might get a bit turned off the Buddhist path. They think, yeah, actually, not so sure about this. Anyway, so practice the whole, every factor, and you will be right. But if you do practice in loving kindness and breath meditation, it means you're doing really well already. So that's great. Then we have from Wolfram in Germany, who asks, how can those Buddhist monks in Burma forget those teachings and turn violent against the Rohingyas? Isn't kindness a matter of heart and not ideology? And again, I think it has all to do with identity. It has to do with the fear that Buddhism is disappearing in the world, the idea that we are to, you know, support Buddhism, and sometimes you go a little bit too far. I'm sure that those monks, they think that they're doing the right thing. Yeah, they think that they're doing things in a worthy way. I don't think they quite understand what is happening here. And so that is what happens when we have this sense of identity. I think that is where the problem really comes from. So let us identify instead with the practice, and I think that might sort most of it out. Then we have Shobi in Sri Lanka, who says 70,000 people were killed in the no-fire zone during the civil war in Sri Lanka, and no justice has been done. How does one react in a Buddhist way? Okay, so how do you react in a Buddhist way? Is that, I'm not sure exactly what you are referring to now, the Buddhist way, it is great to have justice if you like, but sometimes we have to go beyond justice, because sometimes the problems are so deep that to try to actually have justice for everything doesn't work out. Remember in South Africa where they had the truth and reconciliation thing, yeah? They came together, they talked about things, they tried to work things out. To try to kind of have justice for everyone would probably have torn apart South African society so badly that they decided instead to have forgiveness. And what a beautiful example that is. And we should all, I think, try to live up to something like that. It is interesting, if you look at the monastic vinaya, the vinaya are the rules that we have for monastics, there are seven ways of resolving issues in the monastic community. And the last one of those seven ways, is called covering over as if with grass. And that is a situation where there is so much wrangling and dispute and problems in the monastic community. Sometimes you get that in the monastic community as well. I've never seen it, because I live at Bodhinyana. We don't have that sort of things at Bodhinyana Monastery, fortunately. But sometimes these things happen, yeah? Especially when you have large monasteries with maybe 1,000 monks or whatever. It's very easy that these things can arise. And sometimes the wrangling is so bad that if everybody has to confess their offenses and everything, it will just make it worse. And the Buddha says, in those kind of situations, we just cover it over with the grass, all those offenses are annulled, except if they are very serious offenses, then you still have to confess them, and it's all kind of out of the way, and it's like a truth and reconciliation idea. And sometimes we have to do that. Remember, in any conflict, people are deluded. They don't understand what's going on. Compassion and understanding are such incredibly powerful things. And this is what I would recommend in any kind of conflict situation. If we keep on always demanding justice, always demanding that people should go to jail, sometimes the wounds never heal. Sometimes we put people to jail if the situation is right. At other times, it is right just to forgive and move on. And it is up to the different situation, what is possible, to decide the balance between these two things. And there isn't really always a one right way of doing this. So please keep that in mind. In the end, we have to learn to forgive and let go and move onwards. If we don't, these hurts inside of us, we're going to carry them on from life to life. Kind of scary, isn't it? You carry this hurt from life to life, you never give it up, and then there is never any resolution. And because of that, we block our progress in the teachings of Buddhism as a consequence. So, there you are. That's all for Eddie. Yeah, I wonder where you were. Okay, there you are. Yeah. Okay, Eddie wants to ask one last question here.
Sorry, it's easy to point fingers, you know, okay? Like now the Rohingya thing, they point on Buddhists, okay? Yeah. So the thing is, there are similar things, you know, happening in the world too, you know. Like you refer to the Southern Thailand, as far as a few years ago, there was this Muslims too, having problem too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the Southern Philippines too, you know, they're trying to get independence in it. Yeah. The problem lies not with the really like Buddhists or what, it should be, it lies with the government, you know. Okay. Why are these people not happy or what I think, you know? The government can play a very important part, you know. You know, like say for example, our country here, we are multi-religious. But the government is very fair, you know. You understand? So when you're fair this thing, how they say, everybody is happy.
Yeah.
So the government can play a very important part. Maybe in this case, it needs the United Nations, you know, to sit down with the government, this thing, and some religious leaders to involve this thing, to have a dialogue to solve the problem.
Sure, yeah.
That's what I think. So yeah. That's only my thinking.
Yeah, no, that's good. And this is why we have human rights, yeah? Because the idea of human rights is precisely for governments to treat people in the right way, in a good way. So that's kind of what it's all about. So, yes. Thank you for
the
that.
The government can play a very important part.
Yeah. Okay, so let's just pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha as we finish off.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavanta Abhivade Akato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Suppatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.